This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Think about what a family would have to go through if one of their children needed a heart transplant. The doctor visits, the waiting for a donor, the surgery, the recovery. Now multiply that by two.
For two siblings to have a heart transplant, we are, I believe, one of four families in the country to be under those circumstances.
On today's Health Show, we'll hear about a pair of brothers in northern New York State who are both living with other people's hearts and how they're spreading the word about organ donation.
We'll also hear from a heart transplant surgeon about what it's like on the other side of the operating table. And we'll learn about the efforts by 4-H to keep kids around the country healthy. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show.
Two teenagers from northern New York are spreading the word about the importance of organ donation. What makes their effort different is that their family faced a rare circumstance. Both brothers needed a heart transplant. The Health Show's Pat Bradley visited student-athletes Brock and Connor Marvin and talked about their experiences and their advocacy for organ donation.
Brock Marvin is 18 years old and will study sports marketing at college beginning this fall on an athletic scholarship. 16-year-old Connor Marvin is on the soccer team at Elizabethtown Lewis High School. Brock received a heart transplant in December 2010. Younger brother Connor's procedure occurred this year.
I received mine this year, March 1st. Returned to school about a month and a half after, and it's good to be home again.
Now, you both had the heart transplants due to something called dilated cardiomyopathy?
Yep, dilated cardiomyopathy. It's a genetic condition, and it was passed on through our mother, and we unfortunately both inherited it.
And I understand that not everybody has to have a transplant when they have this condition, though.
A lot of times you can live with this condition with medications that regulate different things in your body. You're able to live with it. It can be taken care of. Ours was very severe, so we ended up getting weak enough to the point where we had to have transplants.
How unusual is it for multiple members of a family to get to that point?
I've been told by several people that for two siblings to have a heart transplant, to both have heart transplants, we are, I believe, one of four families in the country to be under those circumstances. So it's really interesting.
Brock, you said you actually had a heart attack.
I did, yeah.
Were you aware that your family even had this disease at that point?
The only thing that we were aware of was that my mom had had heart problems when she was younger. And I was very healthy, very, very healthy. You know, I was in incredible shape for a long time and never thought had any symptoms of, you know, a heart condition. For me, it was a really big shock, you know, when I had the whole attack because I was in such great shape. We had no idea that it was genetic.
How long did you end up being on the waiting list when you were told that you needed to have a heart transplant?
There's different stages of a heart transplant list. There's status 2, there's status 1B and 1A. When you're status 1A, you're basically in the hospital and you need a transplant immediately when you find the right heart. 1B is you can be at home or in the hospital, and 2 is when you're at home. Relatively healthy for somebody who needs a heart transplant. And I waited on status 2 for a heart transplant here at home for about 4 months. And then my heart got so weak to the point where I needed to be in the hospital. I waited 10 days at status 1A and then received my transplant. I was very lucky.
Connor, how about you?
I was put on the heart transplant list in June of 2011. And I was status 2 until November 15th, 2011, and waited. I had a short break home in December over Christmas and went back to the hospital and waited until March 1st. So I had a longer wait in the hospital than he did.
So Connor, having seen what your brother went through, did that make it easier or harder for you?
Everything was much easier for me to know, just to look at him, where he was. He was back on the soccer field when I went in, and it was just great to know that year so I would be doing the same exact thing that he's doing. So he's been a great help to me.
Brock, you're 18, and Connor, you said you're 16. You're very athletic. You're very much into soccer. How big a factor in your recovery from this and still being so healthy is the fact that you were so very active and athletic beforehand?
You know, that's a big difference in our surgeries than you see with a lot of cases, is that although my heart was incredibly weak when I needed the transplant, and Connor's was also, our bodies were in very good physical condition for somebody laying in a hospital bed. And that's why we've done so well post-transplant. We've had no bouts with rejection from the heart. The doctors tell us that because of our bodies in such great physical condition, and our organs, you know, our other organs being in great condition, with the surgery and other things, really went together well, and overall, you know, made for a good surgery, and us being in good shape led to a successful surgery.
What does it say too about the technology of transplants and how far along we've come?
Yeah, since the idea of organ transplants came around, which I believe was the first heart transplant was in the 60s. The medical field has advanced so much technologically. Almost all transplants are successful now. Very, very seldom do you see a transplant go wrong. The doctors and the physicians are very, very careful about picking and choosing hearts that will be good matches for you, lessening the chance of rejection. And with the new medications, as far as anti-rejection medications that we take and blood pressure medications and antibiotics, it really, really, really lessens the chance of bouts with rejection for any transplant recipient.
Despite the fact that yours has been successful, and in the case of you, Brock, you only had to wait about 4 months for your heart. Connor, you said it was a slightly longer wait. You're being very public about your transplants because you're trying to spread awareness about the need for organ transplants. I take it you saw a lot of people that were waiting even longer.
It really confuses me and saddens me when you see people waiting for transplants die. Because in a lot of different countries, basically what they do, you are born somebody who donates your organs if you were to pass, unless you sign up not to be an organ donor. But unfortunately, here in the United States, we have a different policy. And I really try to push the message of organ donation because that's all you really can do. And when you're in the hospital, you meet different families and you make friends with people. And I know in Connor's case, he became very close to the family and their daughter passed waiting for an organ transplant. And that very easily could have been prevented.
I don't see why the USA doesn't have the policy that other countries in Europe do. Like Brock said, the young girl that passed in the hospital, it's sad to see that, and it shouldn't happen. It's doesn't make any sense to me why everyone's not an organ donor.
What do you think the biggest misconception people have about organ donation?
To me, the biggest misconception about organ donation is that people think that their organs, whether they are a smoker, whether they are a drinker, or whatever they are, if they are overweight, whatever it is, sometimes people feel like their organs really wouldn't do anybody any good, which is not true. You know, when I hear people say, well, you don't need this, you don't need this for me, you don't need this, a lot of people do. You'd be surprised. We were very, very lucky to have two people with two good hearts that were donated to us. They were the gifts of life we were given, and we were incredibly lucky. But the biggest misconception is that people think that their organs are a waste, that their organs would do somebody else no good. And, you know, that's pretty upsetting sometimes to hear something like that.
Do you think, too, they focus too much on the major organs? I mean, when somebody signs up for an organ transplant to be an organ donor, I don't think they're thinking about skin or cornea or things like that. And yet, that can be a part of organ donation.
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of times people forget that. People focus a lot on your internal main organs. But forget that you can save, I believe it's up to 15 lives and enhance up to 50 by donating your body.
Brock and Connor Marvin, will you seek out your donor families at all?
I plan on doing my best to be able to somehow get in contact with the family. It is their option whether they'd like to meet me or not, but I'd like that, absolutely.
My wish is to eventually write a letter to them and hopefully meet them someday because they gave me the gift of life, and thank you isn't enough. Thank you will never be enough.
Connor and Brock Marvin received their heart transplants at Children's Hospital in Boston. Reporting for The Health Show, I'm Pat Bradley.
Still to come, what's it like on the other end of a heart transplant? We'll get a look at that picture from one of the country's first female heart transplant surgeons. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1267.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
If you think this next story sounds familiar, well, you're right. After hearing about heart transplants from the Marvin brothers, we thought we'd bring back a portion of our interview with one of the few female cardiothoracic surgeons in the world, Dr. Kathy Magliotto. We spoke a couple of years ago about her book, Heart Matters, a memoir of a female heart surgeon. In it, she remembered an incident that inspired her to specialize in heart transplant surgery.
That happened when I was a general surgery intern, so I had just finished medical school and chosen the path to surgery. So I was just in the very, very early stages of my general surgery training, green as green can be. And my job was to stay out of the way and not kill anybody. That was what I was told when you showed up. So there I was, minding my own business, deliriously tired, standing at the OR board, just kind of looking at the schedule for the day. And a nurse comes out of nowhere and says, "Oh my God, Dr. Netter, you know, needs you in OR 7 stat." And I for the life of me thought, there's just no way she's looking at me. And she grabs me before I know it, and she, and I think I described it as like throwing Kobe beef in a lion's den, she just kind of chucked me in this OR where all heck was breaking loose. Literally, there was blood everywhere, and people were yelling, and carts are tipped over, and it was just total chaos. And here I am, this like little frightened intern, right? So this surgeon looks up from the table where all the blood is shooting up, and he says, "Put on some gloves and get up here." And there's a myth about women surgeons that women make good surgeons because we have small, delicate hands. Well, I will tell you that I have mitts. I have hands that can hold down 13 keys on a piano, and I can palm a basketball. So I've got a grip. Well, that's exactly what Dr. Netter needed. He needed somebody to hold the heart while he whip-stitched the hole shut in it to save the patient's life. So I throw on these gloves and the gown, and I, you know, scared to death, and I come creeping up to the operating table, and I look in, and there's like the heart floating in a sea of blood. I think I described it as a matzo ball in tomato soup. I mean, it just, you know, it looked like that. And I reached in there, and with my big hand, I could just perfectly hold the heart for him to sew it shut. And I got to tell you, Bob, that was it. The minute I held the heart, I thought to myself, oh my God, this is incredible. Because in medical school, you only deal with cadaver hearts, so those are non-beating hearts. But to actually hold the live heart and feel it beat was just amazing. So I said to the cardiac surgeon, I said, "Oh my God, you get to do this every day?" And he looks up at me like I'm an idiot, and he says, "Well, of course I do. I'm a heart surgeon."
Mm-hmm.
That was it. That's when I said, I'm going to be a heart surgeon.
You didn't just stop at heart surgery, though. You went on to learn about transplantation, too, which looks incredibly both frightening and rewarding at the same time.
Well, Bob, the cool thing about transplant surgery is the only heart surgeons that get to actually cut the heart out and lift it out of the chest are heart surgeons. And I thought that that was amazing. Plus, I just so admire transplant patients. I mean, can you imagine that waking up in the morning and looking at a scar on your chest and knowing that someone died to give you that heart? I mean, can you imagine what they live with? The transplant patients are the most, they're the bravest, most courageous, most incredible patients I have ever met, and it was really my honor and privilege to serve these patients and to take a tragic situation like a brain-dead donor and turn it into the most beautiful of circumstances of watching someone live through the death of another human being who gave them the ultimate gift of life.
As you read the book, you can tell you have a real respect and gratitude towards the donors.
Oh, you can't imagine. I mean, to anyone who has signed a donor card, you know, we were so hurting for organs. I mean, on the list right now for hearts transplants is about 4,000 people waiting, and yet we only get about 2,200 hearts a year. So there's always a shortage, and people die a horrible death of heart failure while waiting for a donor organ. So I really encourage people. You know, I saw a bumper sticker that said, don't take your organs to heaven. Heaven knows you need them here.
Well, you have some heartbreaking stories in the book about some people who didn't make it, no matter how hard you worked for them. Do the successes make up for the ones that don't make it?
That's a tough question. You know, that's a tough question, Bob, because the highs are so high, the lows are crushing. You know, when I lose a patient, it's crushing. I don't think a high can quite make up for it, but I do know that when I lose a patient, I have to find this closure inside me that enables me to get up the next day and face the next patient. Some patients just get to me too late, especially women get diagnosed so late. And for those, I try to help, and sometimes, yes, I do lose a patient. To say that the successes make up for it, I'd say no, because I really take it very, very hard when I lose a patient. And the only solace I have is that I come home and I'm greeted by two beautiful children who hug me and are happy to see me and who heal my heart so I can go back out and do it again the next day.
I was thinking about the story that you told about Sylvester in the book, the transplant patient who was recovering for 9 months and you ended up having dinner with him.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And that was wonderful. So I guess that's a great, well, he actually did die a number of times. I don't remember, 4 or 5 full cardiac arrests before he made it out of the hospital. And it was the one story that was a man that I put in the book. But it just as easily could have been any of the many women that I transplanted. It's just that I have a special connection to him. And his name isn't Sylvester. I changed that. I changed all the names to protect the patient's identities. But yeah, that was a patient who had at first an artificial heart implanted and then went on to bridge to finally getting a heart transplant, and then had several cardiac arrests even when he had his heart transplant from other causes. Spent 9 months in the hospital, so to get him out of the hospital is almost akin to basically having a child. And then on my birthday, which was actually the anniversary of his transplant, I transplanted him on my birthday years before, he met me and sat next to me at dinner on my birthday, and that to me was the best gift I could have ever received, because to know that I affected a life like that, that I saved a life like that, just was, I feel like I'm blessed to be able to do that. It's so my honor and my privilege to do it.
Dr. Kathy Magliotto is Director of Women's Cardiac Services at St. John's Health Center in Santa Monica, California. Her book is called Heart Matters, a memoir of a female heart surgeon. When you think of the organization 4-H, you probably think about farms and livestock and country fairs. But the organization has recently begun promoting a competition among leaders nationwide to promote healthy living plans in rural and urban settings. Now, 4-H leaders in 14 states from New Hampshire to Michigan to Hawaii are splitting $800,000 to put those plans into action. Here to talk about the effort is Dr. Madonna Wies, a 4-H extension specialist from the University of Illinois. Dr. Wies, why did 4-H feel this was a project worth doing?
Well, we are making a difference in the lives of kids, and you don't get to say that very often. But 5 years ago, National 4-H made the decision that we really needed to focus our programming on healthy living and getting the message out to the states to focus on the physical, mental, and emotional health of our young people. And at that time, Walmart came alongside and said, you know, this is a great program. We want to partner with you and give you the financial resources in order for the states to make that happen. And so we've implemented the program in 15 states, and we're getting excellent results.
What was the ultimate goal? Was it you just looked at obesity and said we have to tackle this, or was it more general?
While the health statistics are alarming in terms of the weight of our young people, the increase of chronic illnesses that are setting on in childhood, we also know that the positive side of that is If we engage our young people at an early age in learning about their bodies, how to keep it healthy, how to eat well, how to learn about different physical activities so they can find one that they really enjoy and are committed to, then we're going to make a long-term impact on those kids for the rest of their lives, because they're going to carry those healthy habits with them into adulthood. And that's the number one factor in reducing the incidence of chronic illness, is having a consistent, healthy lifestyle.
When the project came about, were the states given guidelines and a goal, or were they just given a goal and said, okay, go wild, come up with something?
Now, each state has a goal of reaching 2,000 youth. Many are far surpassing that goal because we're using a model that's very effective. We're teaching the older youth about healthy lifestyles, good nutrition, physical activity, and then they are going and teaching the younger youth. So we're able to reach more people that way, but those teens go in as role models to the younger children. So if they have a teenager that's talking to them about healthy eating and helping them learn how to make healthy snacks and learn about physical activity and participating with them, then those young people are more likely to do that and to continue doing that. And then the added benefit is then those young people take that message home to their families, and they help their families make better eating choices, and they help their family to get more involved in physical activity.
Give us some examples of what some of the states came up with.
Well, we have a lot of people that are working in gardening programs because it again, is a multi-prong effort that the 4-H youth are learning about where their food comes from, how to grow their food, but they're also helping feed the community with the food, and they're learning how to enjoy and prepare healthy foods. And plus, they get the benefit of the exercise that comes along with gardening. We're also partnering with agencies doing summer nutrition camps where young people come together in day camps and they're preparing healthy snacks. They're learning many types of physical activity. They're learning about nutrition and how to read nutrition labels. So it's all geared towards active learning about good food, and healthy lifestyles.
It must have been interesting working with people from different states. I mean, you have, working with the people from Hawaii was probably very different from the people from New Hampshire, different from the people from Utah.
Yes. And that's why we tried to give the states a model for them to use, but in terms of deciding what needed to happen, where, in what communities, and how, there was a great deal of individual approach in how states did that. So there wasn't a detailed plan laid out for them. They decided what would be the best way to use those dollars in their state.
4-H traditionally has been a rural program and dealing with the food producers. Do you feel that educating food producers about eating healthy may just, you know, either trickle down or trickle up to the people who buy that food?
Oh, most definitely. 4-H did have its roots in agriculture and producing food. And as the program has grown, we are really reaching out into areas that traditionally have not been perceived as being a community of 4-H. But we have 4-H programs in major cities around the country, New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, they all have 4-H programs. And so it's really critical that in those urban environments especially, that we get kids connected back to where their food comes from. But then those producers can also help us teach our kids in terms of how to use that food, how to best grow it, what it does to keep our bodies healthy. So healthy living has to be a community approach.
Dr. Madonna Wiese is a 4-H Extension Specialist from the University of Illinois. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.